This is an ABC podcast. On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Peter Somerville for the Victorian Country Hour.
Good afternoon and a happy new year to you. Coming up on the Country Hour this afternoon, suggestions 14 properties have been completely burnt out and up to 20 damaged around the small community of Pelagio in the state's far west. There's been a community meeting there in just the past hour. We'll bring you the latest from there. But also rainfall. I know we've had a few false starts on this last week, but today is the day. I'm keen to hear from you. How much rain did you get in 2021 and how did it compare to average? We're going to try and build a bit of a picture across the state of how the rainfall cookie crumbled. 0467 842 722, or even better, give me a call. 1300 295 222. We start this afternoon with that fire as emergency crews continue to assess the damage of the fires at Pelagio. BlazeAid, a volunteer disaster relief organisation, is preparing to set up camp there in the next few weeks to help rebuild lost or damaged fences. Founder Kevin Butler spoke to Eden Henninen a short time ago about where things are at and where farmers can donate fodder.
The fires are just out now. And what we know from talking to farmers down there is that the fire burnt out 7,000 hectares. There are 14 properties minimum that have been fully burnt out or partially burnt out. There are thousands of sheep that have been put down as we speak and have been put down and euthanised. Some cattle, but it's mainly sheep, first cross ewes and composites and some merinos. There's a lot of fencing that's been destroyed. Now, some of it's insured, a lot of it's not. What we invariably find is there's only partial insurance because no one thinks a fire is going to hit them, or maybe the next generation might get a fire, but not us. There's a lot of fencing along native forest as well, and because of the kangaroo problem, that will have to be exclusion fencing. So there's going to be a massive job on the clean-up of fencing and the rebuilding of new fencing. So BlazeAid's starting up officially from the Eden Hope Showgrounds on Monday the 17th of January, and we expect to be helping these farmers for the next, or from then to perhaps several weeks to maybe 2 or 3 months.
And so you said, Kevin, that there's about 14 properties at the moment that you know of that have been burnt out.
Yeah, it's touted up to 20. Some have been partially burnt, but we on good authority, there's 14. And the fire was just massive in its destruction for those 14. And there was, there's been very heavy stock losses. With the fodder situation, we've got two local farmers that are receiving fodder, one on the north side, Peter Kerr, and one on the south side, Celia. And they have got tractors and machinery, forks on their tractors to take fodder off. They are wanting fodder, but of course they're very specialised and very professional farmers. They want quality fodder and fodder that doesn't have any weeds in it or weed seed in it. There are neighbours who are offering to take on adjustment for cattle or for sheep, but as we know, adjustment is only for a short period of time, and it's going to take some months for the fences to be rebuilt and some months for the rains to come for the grass to grow again. So the fodder is going to be very, very important. Even if it sits in the paddock for a while at Celia's and Peter's, I think it's going to be a good idea that it's there for those farmers that have, for their livestock that are going to be in containment areas.
Farmers in the area are saying it's the worst fire to hit the area since the 1950s. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, I was looking at some photos on the ABC website there, and taken from some volunteer firefighters, and they were just ferocious, and I think it was probably an unstoppable fire while the resources were being mustered. And I just congratulate all the locals and the firefighters and the CFA and units from South Australia that just stopped it. I mean, what a magnificent effort. What we invariably find, and I've been doing this for 12 years, is that farmers and locals will be certainly very happy, and they'll seem happy that the fire is out and that they're doing well. But after about a week or a fortnight, the full gravity of the situation sinks in after they've got some sleep, and there's a massive workload in front of them in rebuilding. So I just hope that, you know, anyone who's able to help do come to Blaze on and after the 17th of January. We do go 7 days a week. Also, if you can't come, just consider donating to the Post and Wire program, because there's going to be virtually millions of dollars worth of fencing that's got to be put up to reinstate those farmers back to where they were. So, you know, those farmers will have a double whammy. You know, not only have they been shell-shocked from the hit of the fire, they'll also be suffering from nightmares as I did after the Black Saturday fire. So they psychologically, they've got to get over that. And then, you know, if they've bought a farm just recently or if they've got a heavy mortgage and their insurance is a bit sus, they've got a, you know, they've got a few issues in front of them, and the line that stops anything terrible from happening is the aid that comes in from kind people all over Australia who donate Post and Wire or who physically come and help.
Blaze Aid founder Kevin Butler speaking there with Eden Henninen. For more information on Blaze Aid, of course, you can head to their website. And you might have heard mention of Celia Scott there. Stick with us on the Country Hour because we're hoping to hear more from Celia later on in the show. Angus Verley has travelled to Pelagio this morning and has caught up with Celia. There's been a community meeting held in town just in the past hour or so. It could possibly still be going. So we'll aim to catch up with Angus and Celia later in the program. You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour. Now, on 1300 295 222 today, I'd love to hear from you. We're talking rainfall. How much did you get last year? How does it compare to normal? Was it good, bad? Maybe it was just ugly. Let me know, 1300 295 222, or of course you can send a text if you're not up for a chat, 0467 842 722. A couple of texts here already. G'day to Evan at Painsville. He's had 930 millimetres last year. That's well up on the average, 695. Staying in Gippsland. G'day also to Nigel at Vespa at 1,663.9 millimetres for the year. I'd love to know how Nigel's measuring 0.9 of a millimetre, but nonetheless, that's an impressive total. What's that, more than 1.5 metres? Thanks also, Alex from Savanac, 622.5 millimetres there for 2021. That's also well up on Alex's average of 450 millimetres. And good afternoon as well to Ruth at Rural Leongatha, 1,054 for 2021. Just slightly up on 1,000 for her average there. If you'd like to get in touch, 1300 295 222, or send me a text, 0467 842 722.
Nominations are now open for Farmer of the Year, with 10 categories spanning all ages and stages of life on the land. Let's recognise the hard work of our rural leaders, innovators and farming legends, and celebrate those in our rural sector who go above and beyond. You can enter yourself or someone you know at farmeroftheyear.com.au. Presented by ABC Rural and the Kinderning Group.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Now, if you're a grain grower, I'd like you to think back on 2021 and just distill the year in a single word. What would that word be? As we push into the new year, I put that question to Farm & Co. Grain Marketing Advisor Adrian Clancy. We recapped grain markets in 2021 and the factors that you might hear more about this year.
Generally, it has been a positive season, particularly with the change, the diversity being in the markets and the weather, really.
So 2021, a diverse year for grain markets. Is that's what we'll put it down as?
No doubt. I think that probably pretty well covers it.
Talk us through some of that. There's been some highs and lows. What have they been?
Well, I suppose initially looking at the season, as far as the season, the growing season is probably where we start. We had seen a little bit of rain earlier in the season. March was relatively wet, particularly looking in the area I am, sort of southern New South Wales, northeast Victoria. Appreciate it has been drier in the western part of Victoria. So March was very wet and people were very optimistic. Canola was a big focus. We then got into a position pretty much through April and May where it didn't rain. So whilst people were very encouraged by moisture profile in March rolling into April, there was a lot of canola went in the ground. It was actually surprising how much the issues we saw with canola around germination. Basically, some went in early, some went in late, some germinated very well, others was very sporadic due to the fact that we just didn't get a really good follow-up rain, even to a point that a certain amount of canola was sprayed out as we got through to May, where growers were just too concerned about the fact that it hadn't got a great establishment. And that it just really wasn't going to perform. The surprising thing from that, we then got into June and it got wet. And also to finish off the season, we ended up with a fairly soft finish to the season. Now, probably a fair bit softer than some wanted due to the fact that it kept raining, but it was quite surprising how canola was able to perform from a position where it really didn't look like it had any hope at all. So probably that on the climatic. Now, obviously, as we go further west, it's probably been drier throughout the season, and well understand that some of those in the Mallee are in a position of just getting back seed. Central probably looking, particularly sort of in southern New South Wales, looking pretty good, and definitely in my eastern part here. It has been rain pretty much throughout, and that's sort of, whilst we've got yields, quality has been impacted.
It sounds then like there's been a bit of anxiety for grain growers this year.
I think anxiety would go very well with the diversity. it definitely has. As far as the growing season, you know, and the issues around canola, just knowing whether it's sort of going to perform, and then getting into a position where canola's generally yielded fairly well. Marketing was slow. We saw prices start off relatively well, but then as we've got in later into this season, we have seen those canola values hit record values. Basically, in the past, you know, 700 was pretty much a record value. We topped out at sort of numbers to a port number up to around $1,000. Now that's come back well back from that mark now, but it also creates anxiety when people sell for 700 and it goes to 900. But now it's sort of settled back as well. We've seen that real change in the market. The other thing, as far as the anxiety, is once you lock into some of these contracts and you don't have the grades available, being able to find and source that grain definitely creates a level of anxiety as well.
Yeah, a real headache, I'm sure. You mentioned prices there. Can we perhaps take a bit of a broader look, maybe internationally? What's been affecting those prices this year on a global scale?
So the big factors that we're looking at was the US, Canada. US and Canada, particularly the northern parts of the US, were very dry, and we saw a reduction in yield for wheat. Canada had some record dry conditions, record dry and hot conditions, heavily impacted barley, wheat, and being a big canola producer out of Canada. Europe, we saw, generally wasn't such a bad crop. Their canola plantings were back, but we also saw rain around harvest, and it really impacted quality there. Getting into Russia, the Russian production, It initially quoted at sort of nigh on record levels. It progressively dropped back as we got into harvest. So we saw a reduction in the capacity of the Russian crop to export, and subsequently we've seen export tariffs come in there, which restricts the amount of wheat that'll hit the international market. So they're all very big players in the market between the US, Canada, Europe and Russia. So as a result, we've seen the world short of milling, and we've seen a tightness on canola, which has sort of boosted those prices. But we've also seen demand for feed grain, where basically any milling capacity will go into milling, and therefore, you know, a little bit of an opportunity for feed grains, both lower quality wheat and barley.
Adrian, coming back home, of course, it's a busy time now for growers and yourself, of course, but how are you feeling? How are growers feeling as we move into the new year?
Well, I think most are probably relatively tired after another run of some warmer conditions. And I think most probably really the big focus is getting harvest completed at this point in time. No doubt there will be a sense of relief once that's achieved. Generally, although we've seen these ups and downs with prices and production, generally the crop on a dollars per hectare situation will be good. There's no doubt, you know, the old adage about money in mud rather than dust. We've seen generally some good production, particularly across the eastern side, and the markets have been generally good as well. So I think most will be happy to see the end of the season, but it won't be too bad on a financial level either. Relative, yes, it could have been substantially higher for some, but yeah, it won't be the worst.
What do you think the headlines of 2022 will be? What are the big issues or the big ticket items that we'll be speaking about?
Well, I think if you can, as far as the market goes, it's that international drive from those, you know, the demand for particularly milling wheat and canola. So that's probably a focus of the headlines, and that's dry conditions predominantly throughout Russia, US and Canada. And on the other side of it, and we've seen it happen before, it's wet conditions or generally, you know, very good conditions across. And again, acknowledging there's parts of Western Victoria that have really suffered. But when you look at the widespread rain across Australia, yes, it's definitely caused the biggest issues across New South Wales. But that widespread rain, you know, basically from Queensland through to WA, resulting in big yields will be the headline. And locally, it's probably a lot of pictures of bogged headers and a slow harvest.
That's Adrian Clancy, a grain marketing advisor. And if you have a look online at abc.net.au/rural, you'll see how that picture stacks up against other commodities. So much hanging on the weather there in grain markets this year, and we're discussing that on the Country Hour this afternoon. Give me a call, 1300 295 222, and let me know how much you've had. Alan from Cosgrove has done just that. He's called in on that number. Alan, welcome to the Country Hour.
Welcome, Peter and listeners.
Where's Cosgrove? Where are you?
About 20 kilometres east of Shepparton and about 8 kilometres east toward Dookie.
Now, you're in a truck. You're harvesting at the moment.
Yes, we're still going.
How's it going?
The 300 acres of wheat to go, and 160 of barley, and 115 of beans, 80 acres of lupin. We'll be going for a little while yet.
You've still got a bit on. Now tell us the all-important question. How much rain did you get last year?
I had 22 inches and 66 points. I think it's 500, and I did work it out in mils, but it's only about 25 mils above my average rainfall year. I've had records kept for donkey's years in around Dookie.
I was going to ask you to translate that for us, so you, that's good. Maybe perhaps someone could text in with a really accurate translation there. How does that fare? Is it good, bad, or ugly?
No, it was wet enough at times. I think in July we had a very dry start. Some of the canola wasn't, you know, come up real good. I had two tractors broken down. I had a friend come and spread urea on the black ground. It was fairly late, and it ended up at nearly 4 tonne of canola to the hectare.
We heard in that last package there was a bit of maybe anxiety, or there was quite a swing in canola pricing last year. How did you fare in all of that? Did you get your hopes up when it spiked?
I locked 50 tonne in at 650, what was it, $47, and I had 50 tonne in at 953. And I haven't sold a lot yet. I've been selling wheat.
Well, Alan, good luck with it, and thanks for calling in.
Yep, all the best to everyone.
Cheers, and to you. Alan there from Cosgrove sharing his rainfall figures from last year, 2021. We're recapping your annual rainfall on the Country Hour today. 1300 295 222 is the number.
The Victorian Country Hour with Peter Somerville on ABC Radio Victoria.
Now, this being the 3rd of January, you might have seen a bit of wine in the past few days. You mightn't want to see any more for a while, but the chances are you bought your wine in a bottle. But these days, you can buy it in a lot of different forms of packaging. While bottles are still the most common, it can be purchased in cans and casks, or by the keg if you're having a party. But a winery near Mildura has decided to sell 1.5-litre pouches that come with a tap. Anthony Murphy from Trentham Estate explains why the company has made the move away from glass.
It's been a long time in the making, but really the pouch is so environmentally friendly compared to glass that we decided to, you know, to go down that track, really. The estimates are 80% less impact on the environment than glass, and the weight of the bottles is a big factor, so a lot better transport-wise, and also less waste as well. With a package like this, it weighs very little. It's a much more friendly package.
How long's the pouch been around for with Trentham Estate Wine in it?
For us, it's only been around about 6 months, but the pouch itself, there's a development that came out of Germany, and that's been around for about 10 years now.
Has it been hard to find someone that would package wine in the pouches? What kind of effort have you had to go to find someone to do that kind of thing?
The biggest hurdle we had was actually sourcing the pouches at a reasonable cost, and we've managed to do that. It took us quite a while to find someone who could do it without doing hundreds of thousands of pouches. So it took us probably 5 years to find someone to do it. So, yeah, it's been great for us to be able to launch it.
And it's Pinot Grigio and Pinot Noir that you've put in the pouches. Why did you pick those two varieties?
They're probably the most popular, white and red at the moment. We're also looking at a rosé as well down the track. You know, we can quite easily extend the range if we need to. The only thing is the lead time, about 6 months to get the pouches made. That's the biggest hurdle.
Consumers would want to know that the wine still tastes the same. Is there any difference between buying wine in a bottle and buying it in a pouch?
Not really. The shelf life is not as long. So in a bottle, you know, white wines generally are consumed within 12 months, and it's recommended with the pouches to consume within 8 months.
Do they have a longer life, though, once they're open, given that I'm assuming that there wouldn't be any of that oxidisation that might happen with a bottle?
That's right. That's a beauty of it. You can just take one glass if you want and pop it back in the fridge, and it'll last quite well for, you know, another 7 months.
Do you need to modify how you market a product like this compared to a standard 700ml bottle?
We do. We've put a lot of work into promotions and recognition of the product. So it's, you know, we're not there yet, but we're getting there. We've put a lot of money into marketing spend and tastings. So it is quite an effort to make it work.
You're encouraging people to take it on picnics and things like that where it might not be appropriate to have glass. Is that how you're marketing it to consumers as well?
Yes, it is. It is a convenience factor, you know, going out on a picnic or just on the road, you know, for a holiday or whatever, out in the bush. You know, it's an ideal. You can just drink one glass and keep the rest for another time.
And I understand that at the moment you don't even have it for sale at the cellar door. Is that right?
No, we don't. We've already got quite a range of wines at cellar door. So we really just haven't got the space at this stage. But who knows, down the track we may do.
Anthony Murphy from Trentham Estate speaking there with Kelly Hollingworth. 28 minutes past 12 on the Country Hour. We'll get the latest news headlines in just a moment. Just quickly circling back to your rainfall messages again. Firstly, thank you to Lex from Bairnsdale for calling in. He pointed out that 22.6 inches is 574 millimetres. And now to a few more of your messages. What have we got here? Stephen at Yarrock near Kenaiva, the long-term average there, 420 millimetres with an annual 300 in the growing season. In 2021, we had 333 with 228 in the growing season. Late frosts reduced harvest by about 67%. Goodbye 2021 with an exclamation mark, Stephen says. And hello to Mike at Bragalong, 975 millimetres last year, well up on an average of 653.6. You've got to include the 0.6 when you're talking annual averages, don't you? And Graham from Halston, north of Leongatha, called in as well with an annual rainfall, 1,278 millimetres. about average for that part of the world. A few of your texts coming in about that last story we played, pouched wine or wine in a pouch. I just have to read these out because they're making me laugh, especially this one here in caps, all caps. Who drinks one glass of wine? And also Chris in Western Victoria wants to know, what's the difference between a wine pouch and a cask, other than that a cask is a pouch in a box? That's a very good point, Chris. We might have to come back to you on that. Let's circle back now to those bushfires. That 7,000 hectare fire, which is not yet extinguished, burning near Pelagio, just on our side of the Victoria-South Australian border. Your Horsham-based rural reporter Angus Furley has travelled to Pelagio this morning and can join us now. Hi, Angus.
G'day, Pete.
Where are you and what can you see?
That's right, Pete. So I am here. I've just stepped out of the Pelagio Memorial Hall where there's been a community meeting held this morning with various fire authorities to bring the locals up to speed. I guess in terms of fire risk, it's no longer an evolving situation. The fire, it's contained, and I think it's expected to be listed as under control this afternoon. There are still some small areas, I guess, burning but not spreading in state forest. Where I'm standing right now, just outside the Pelagio Hall, I'm essentially surrounded by burnt ground. So the fires that's come all the way around the hall and burnt sort of to the edge of Pelagio Township before, I believe there was a wind change and it headed back further to the northeast. The fire started Friday afternoon, New Year's Eve. It was started by a car fire just across the border, a matter of metres across the border at Rattenbully, and then it's burnt in an easterly direction. I think the full spread of the fire from west to east, probably about 20 kilometres. As you said, just under 7,500 hectares burnt, and a whole lot of damage, as you'd imagine, with fencing, shedding, and of course, livestock losses.
Yeah, absolutely. And scary to contemplate that it's come so close into town as well, so close to the hall. You've just been at the community meeting there. What was the mood like in that meeting? What was discussed?
Oh, look, as you imagine, it was a pretty serious mood. It certainly wasn't upbeat. And people, I guess they wanted guidance on where to from here, what support's going to be available to do some of those things like burying dead animals, replacing fencing, assessing trees. So we're in red gum, sort of the heart of red gum country here. So towering red gums, a lot of those have been seriously burnt and they're a real hazard. And that's why there are still road closures. As I look up the road here, there've been excavators working all morning, clearing some of those trees, pulling down other trees that were deemed to be a risk. So people are worried about all of those things. There are some people who've lost many hundreds, even thousands of livestock. Some properties have got not a blade of grass left on them. So I suppose overall, as compared to some of the other fires we sometimes talk about, the area, 7,500 hectares, it mightn't be enormous if you're comparing it to some of those fires in the northeast, but when you've got individual farmers that have been entirely burnt out, then you can't really overstate the significance of it.
Absolutely. That's a huge, that horrible word, impact for those people. Now, in that community meeting, was there any update on road closures or relief or recovery assistance that might be coming?
So in terms of road closures, there've been when I came out from Horsham this morning, there were a couple of road closures. I had to go through a police road block. I think this afternoon that's going to go from being a road block to just signage advising people of what lies ahead. That's for the major roads. There'll be other local roads that are impassable. They'll be waiting for graders. There are graders working in the area. They'll be waiting for graders to go down and grade away debris, branches, whatever it may be. So that's one thing. Other support available, Blaze Aid. People probably would well know Blaze Aid as that fire relief organisation. They had volunteer coordinators here this morning. They'll be setting up a camp in nearby Edenhope. I think they're hoping to have that camp established on, it's the 17th of January. They'll have volunteers that'll start working from then. So I guess what Blaze Aid really does is focus on getting that crucial fencing back up. For some people that will take years, but in the immediate term, if you have no fencing and you have livestock, then you need at least somewhere to put those livestock so you can feed them initially before you start working on some of your broader boundary fencing. So yeah, a lot of work ahead, and a lot of that work's going to be done, as it so often is, by volunteers.
It's so hard to comprehend how terrible the situation is out there for those people. But how are the locals going? And I believe that you've got some there with you.
Ideal, and I'll introduce people now to Celia Scott. If you could come in, Celia. Celia, you're a local farmer. You've got farmland literally a matter of metres from us that's been totally burnt out.
Yeah, we haven't. Thanks for having me, Angus. We have, and we were incredibly lucky that we managed to get stock onto a summer crop. We lost acreage and a 40-hectare hay crop that hadn't been carted yet. So we were incredibly lucky compared to what some of our friends and neighbours have gone through.
And as you say, Celia, lucky, and I think it was just the whim of the wind, which meant that a whole lot of your land, which was looking very threatened, ended up escaping unscathed.
Yeah, and while in this situation one has a moment of thinking, oh, we're lucky, we missed out, but at the same time there's the guilt of what everyone else is going through. You don't wish a wind. You wish you could stop it rather than that it's a wind change that takes it away from your property. But it just came with such speed and such ferocity that we just, there was nothing that anyone could do except what we had to do.
And Celia, I imagine that given the fire has burnt all in its path, there are going to be some farmers, some properties that are essentially entirely burnt out.
Yeah, look, there's some. Farmers around here that have, as you mentioned earlier, lost absolutely every blade of grass, and unfortunately a lot of them lost a lot of their livestock. There's a couple of properties that are 90% plus that they've lost all of their that many livestock, it is a challenge that's going to keep going for a long time.
And just in terms of those livestock, we heard this morning from Dr. Paul Belts, who's an Ag Vic vet. He gave the figures, I think, around 4,600 sheep had either perished in the fire or they'd had to be put down since then. That number might even be on the low side as more information comes to light. I think that was across 16 or 17 properties. I suppose, can you try and, not that you've had to go through it in this case, in this instance yourself, Celia, but can you try and encapsulate what that must have been like for those farmers who've not only had the heartbreak of the fire and the shock of having a fire sweep through their properties, but then they've had to get up and get out straight away and really start shooting their own livestock.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, you feel for them and you try and do what you can, but I don't think until you live it you can really fully understand it. There has been an amazing amount of community support to help those farmers deal with what they had to deal with. And as anyone that's a farmer or is linked to farming knows, you do what you have to do as soon as you can. So when it came to euthanizing stock, everyone got on to try and stop their animals from suffering.
And of course, you talked about being able to move some of your stock into the yards, I guess, out of harm's way. But just the nature of the fire, how, as I said, it burned everything in its path. It spread very quickly, tinder dry conditions, very hot, windy as well. And this is a case where these livestock have perished through no fault of farmers. They were just in a terrible situation where there was nothing that could be done.
Yeah, and look, there are CFA volunteers on fire trucks whose places have been completely burnt out, and the fire wasn't headed in that direction, and the wind change brought it straight onto their place, and they're the guys that you just have, you feel so much for, that they were supporting other people in the community, and they got it themselves.
And there was a pretty strong sentiment as well this morning in the meeting, Celia, from the authorities, that as bad as this fire has been, as much damage as it's done, it could have been a lot worse if the response wasn't, I suppose, as swift and decisive as it was. I think 9 waterbombing aircraft, literally hundreds of volunteers, dozens of volunteer CFA appliances. So 7,500 hectares, 18 properties, but if that response had been less than what it was, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, look, in as as a CFA volunteer and you're making decisions on the fly, you can only make decisions with the information that you've got at a situation. Of course, one looks back after and thinks, oh, we wish we'd done this differently, but in those situations, you make the best decision you can with the information that you have. So, and we do our, everyone does their bit with trying to prepare for a fire season and trying to set their place up and have a fire plan. But in weather like what we had on New Year's Eve, and faced with the kind of fire we had, some of that just doesn't help.
And just finally, Celia, it's a tough question. We've talked about the support that Blaze Aid's going to provide, but what's the road back for those farmers who are now looking at their farms that have no fences, maybe very few livestock left and no grass? Well, where to from here for them?
Oh, I can't imagine what the next step's going to be for them and taking that, starting to step in that direction. I suppose that's going to be something that comes up further down the track. Yesterday, the core focus, we managed to get majority of livestock dealt with, and we've done that immediate thing, and the next thing is rebuilding, and that's going to be different people are going to do that in different ways, and I don't think everyone's going to do it the same way, and
it's tough.
Yeah it is, and everyone's just going to have to take their own time to deal with it. So I think for a lot of people, they don't know, and it's not something that's going to become clear for some time yet.
Thanks so much, Celia. Tough to talk about, so appreciate making the time.
No worries. Thanks, Angus.
Thanks, Celia. So that was Celia Scott there, a local CFA captain and also local farmer, Pete, whose property has been badly affected. And hopefully that we've brought you there. It's certainly we haven't given you the full...
Angus, we've lost you right at the most crucial time. Angus Verley there, he was speaking with Celia Scott, who is speaking with such amazing strength. Of course, here at the Country Hour, we hope everyone out there is staying strong, and I guess look forward to all that help Blaze Aid arriving, and no doubt there'll be other support on the way as well. It's 10 minutes to one. This is the Victorian Country Hour.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Really not quite sure how we move on from that, but perhaps some miniature goats might do the thing. A high school student in southwest Victoria has turned a passion into a growing business by picking up on a trending pet. In addition to his studies, the Year 11 student from Kooramungal has tapped into the market of breeding miniature goats. Jane McNaughton went to visit Charlie earlier this year and filed this report.
So these are the baby goats, so they were born this year. This one is named Gabby, and this one's named Starla. When we got Gabby, we got her with her mum, and Starla was originally bottle-fed, so she's actually quite, you know, human-friendly, and so's Gabby. When we put them in, they... You know, there was a bit of a struggle for them to get close to each other and who was, you know, the king of the pack. But in the end, now they're actually really close and like to stick together. And when we let them out, they stay together and do the same sort of things.
So what inspired you to get the mini goats?
When we first found them online, we just thought they were super cute and friendly and we loved their personality. And then when we dove deeper into researching them, and found Charlie online, we found that there was also a breeding and a show aspect that we really liked.
Is Charlie a little bit of an inspiration to you?
Yes, he is.
So what's your ambition with these goats? They're obviously beloved pets, but are you going to be breeding, or what are you going to do with the goats?
I think the plan is, yes, to keep them as pets and keep them friendly, but in time to also have them at shows and to breed them for younger ones as well, that we can then become a part of that sort of breeding stock and selling.
James, how old are you?
13.
It's quite ambitious. Why do you enjoy this so much?
I just love looking at them and playing with them. And, you know, when we bring them out, they just have such great personalities and running around, and it's so awesome to look at.
Do you want to get them out?
We can,
let's
yes.
Do it.
Hello.
So, Lana, you're James's mum. What's your opinion on the goats?
I didn't realise that they would be so engaging. I didn't anticipate that they would become such pets, and so that's been a real plus.
Obviously, James enjoys it too. Has it become a family activity?
It's totally a family activity because we've had to goat-proof the property. We'd anticipated that, sort of like other livestock, they'd be out in the paddocks, but instead we've built goat pens quite close to the house so that we can see them and interact with them. And we've realised that's what makes them much more friendly. So that'll be an appeal for us for when they're kidding, but also so that when we do breed them, that we'll be able to sell friendly animals. And that was obviously a big consideration and something we learnt from the Breeders Association. They jump on you. There are lots of antics. Jump on your back and ride on your shoulders. And yeah, it's like having circus animals, pets.
So, James, as far as things that are your job, what actually do you need to do to take care of the goats?
Regularly, I redo all of their food and their hay for their beds. A lot of the time, it is that every 8 to 10 weeks when we do their nails. And it's also playing with them and bringing them out so that they have new experiences and don't get bored, because they do really need a lot of attention.
When we do get to start going to these goat shows, do you think it'll be a really good social experience as well for you?
Yeah, to meet people who are, you know, similar in loving these goats and loving these things, that'll be great. And also, you know, there'll be people like Charlie who are also, you know, younger and like to do this sort of thing, to meet similar people.
Are you planning on getting many more goats?
I think the plan is we hold off buying any new ones and we wait for next year when we can breed them.
That was James DeCourt from Clunes in Western Victoria, speaking about his miniature goats with Jane McNaughton. Been chatting a bit about your annual rainfall for 2021 on the program this afternoon. You can, of course, give me a call, 1300 295 222, though we might be running out of time for that. 0467 842 722 is probably the way to go. Although we do have Wally from Murrayville on the line. Hi, Wally.
Yeah, g'day, Peter.
How much rain did you get last year?
I had 1114 points, or in the modern figures, about 278.5 millimetres.
And how does that compare to your average?
Well, the last 40 years, I don't know what you'd call average. It's so up and down, more downs and ups over the last 40 years. But, yeah, it was such a slow start to the first 6 months, but the last 6 months wasn't too bad, although it was dry again in a bit dry in August and September, but yeah, we did all right. It was probably somewhere getting around near average. I know up until about the 80s, we used to average about 13.5 inches a year, but that's dropped away with so many dry years in the last 40. I'm out between Murrayville and the Big Desert, and that's about 110, 120 kilometres west of Hogan.
Yeah, there's so much variability in it. Well, Wally, thanks for calling in.
That's all right, Peter. A pleasure.
Cheers. Thanks, Wally. Now, we do have a few more figures as well here on the text line, starting with Craig at Hillside, 5 kilometres west of Bensdale, 992 for the year, well above the average of around 650 there. I can tell you it is looking very good in that part of the world at the moment. Sale, 788 for the year against an average of 625. This text says the Latrobe River has fallen, at least giving the floodplain a break after 9 months of having a couple of metres of water on it. Leo, g'day, Pete. Gundaring has done very well last year with a total of 1,080 millimetres, which is way up on 2020 at 787, and even better again than 2019 when they had 680 millimetres there. Thanks for that, Leo. Charlie says reports around 600 millimetres for the year at Barmer East. For the year, the harvest's all done and dusted with some of the best yields that Charlie has seen. Now, this one as well, I'd really like to come back to these texts too. Picking up from that cross that we just heard with Angus Furley there, Jono on the borderline. Well done, Angus. pretty happy with that cross, I think. And also, Chris again in Western Victoria, speaking from past experience, the most monumental and heartbreaking task immediately after a fire is dealing with those dead and dying livestock, which I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you there. And we circle back to rainfall because the screen is just refreshed and I've got two more for you. Penny at Yumbunna, 475 millimetres, and Mark at Croxton East near Hamilton, which Mark says is surprisingly a little below average at 564 millimetres for the year. That is about all we have time for on your on the Country Hour this afternoon. Thanks so much for listening in. Thank you for all of our rainfall texters and callers. Been great having you along. Of course, can't really do it without you. Right now, though, it's 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon.